I'd like to thank the organizers, Daniel in particular, Ephraim, and Paul Broomer as well, for having me here. And I would also like to thank Yelena this morning for being flexible to switch around with me. I apologize for that. Okay, so I'm going to talk for the next half hour on trapped ions, pretty much. And I guess this morning we heard that there have been lots of experiments in the past 10 or 15 years with fewer than 10 qubits that are cute but useless. And I guess as somebody who kind of made the early part of my career on cute but useless experiments, I take that to heart. But I'm also very pleased to report in the last several years that the world of ion trapping has really grown. When I started in this in the early 90s, there were you could count the number of groups on one hand if that hand had one finger, or one or two fingers. And so these groups I list here, almost all of them are very young. And so this, to me, is a really good sign that there's some new ideas out there, and there have to be different competing visions of what these ion traps are good for and how they can scale up. See, after all, that's the name of the game in ion trapping now. We have to get beyond the cute experiments. They're all done. And, well, maybe not quite up to 10, but we have to think about how to scale it. And a lot of thoughts, of course, been expended in that direction, and I want to talk about a few in particular. Now, there are a couple of... If you don't know so much about the ion system, there are a couple of more review, the Scientific American is very pedestrian, of course, and then a little more technical review article by my colleagues Reiner Blott in Innsbruck and David Wineland at NIST. So this is a picture of one of our ion traps at Maryland. It's not exactly a chip. It's three chips that have been screwed together, so you can see it's not a monolithic chip like a Pentium, but it's pretty small nonetheless, and with this trap we can hold several ions in a linear crystal like this one here. Our ion of choice is ytterbium plus. It almost doesn't matter as long as you have a charge and you have appropriate electronic levels. You can do pretty much anything you want. All the schemes are pretty much transportable. But let me get off the atomic physics for 20 seconds. The ytterbium system is very simple. It has a spin 1/2 nucleus. So the quantum numbers are identical to that of hydrogen. So we're all used to that. The four ground state S1/2 levels, two of them form our quantum bit. These are the so-called clock state qubits because they have no Zeeman shift to lowest order. And so we do apply a weak field to split these three levels, the F equals 1 manifold, and we're left with a small residual quadratic Zeeman shift. So in other words, we don't really even have to magnetically shield the system. It's pretty well isolated from the environment. Our coherence times have been observed to be a few seconds. They could probably be a few minutes if we had an atomic clock nearby and had really good shielding. Okay, so there's where we store the qubit. And, of course, you probably know or have heard in atomic physics and ions in particular, we can detect such qubits with very high efficiency. And that's because the properly designed atomic qubit has what's called a cycling transition. When you shine light on it at the right, say, wavelength or polarization and so forth, only one of the two qubit states will fluoresce. In this case, we have to shine all three polarizations of near UV light here. For those experts in the cold atom community, this is not a dark state because of the weak magnetic field lifts the degeneracy. We scatter a lot of photons if we're in what I call the spin-up state, whereas if we're in the spin-down state, that same light is pretty far away from resonance. It's 12 gigahertz away from a 20 megahertz line width line, so it's largely dark. So these two states, we can look at each individual atom, and with about 99% accuracy in our current experiments, we can detect their spin state up or down. Okay, so I want to talk about two different visions and on how we might consider linking ions. And the first one is probably more conventional. You've heard of it, naturally involving the Coulomb interaction. Ions, if you form a crystal of ions, they interact very strongly. Their external states interact very strongly. It's just a matter of coupling that to the internal states to make entanglements, to make gates. And that's pretty much where 95% of the work in ion trap quantum gates have been, ion traps in quantum information science. And I'll also talk a little later about a competing version involving photons. Okay. So basically, I won't give a big introduction to using the Coulomb interaction to entangle ions. You've probably heard it before. They all involve the same thing. They all involve a spin-dependent force, and you'll find this is true of many systems involving spin. If you can apply a spin-dependent force, in this case, since the spins are also charged, that allows us to do exactly what we want, to couple the spins to the motion. So if this is the quantum operator, it looks like a classical operator. You're just applying a force to harmonic oscillators. But it's quantum because, in this case, it's a weird force that takes spin up and moves it, say, up with a positive force, and spin down and moves it down. So this little animation, if you zoom two laser beams on, if you focus two laser beams on ions number 4 and, I won't count, and 15, then if they were in a superposition of spin, they will now be in a superposition of motion. Okay? And if you consider this situation, there are a few regimes. If you do it too slowly, then, of course, all the springs connecting the rest of the atoms will notice, and you'll have all the normal modes. It's kind of a mess. You can deal with it. They're perfect harmonic oscillators, perfect to 6 or 7 digits, really, in most cases. And so we can do the math. It's not so bad. What might be more interesting, and this hasn't been exploited quite yet, is if we do it super fast, that is fast compared to all the normal modes, then there's no time for this motion to get transmitted all the way across, and we have a straight dipole-dipole interaction. Okay, these are charges, but they interact via a dipole-dipole coupling because we've sort of created, in a brute force way, an electric dipole. The charge is there and there at the same time. And so this, you'll have a 1 over r cubed, 1 over distance cubed interaction, and it's interesting to note that current experiments pretty much make displacements on the order of 10, 20 nanometers. That corresponds to a dipole moment, which is pretty big. In weird units called debis, it's about 1,000 debis. So this is on the order of what you hear in Rydberg atoms, for instance, and many other coupled dipole systems. Let's see, I guess I won't talk about this too much, although it is an active area, especially in our lab. I'll talk, with regard to the Coulomb gates, I'll talk some more about the slow, more conventional type. Okay, so to scale the system up, we're not going to put a million ions in a single trap and hope to control all those million modes, 3 million modes of motion. So many of you may have heard of this proposal from several years ago that Dave Kopinski, Dave Weiland, and I promoted. And the idea was to control a few ions, control their simplified degrees of freedom of phonons, and when the entanglement's done of the spin, then actually physically move the ions in different parts of an apparatus. So you need a very complicated ion trap that has lots of electrodes, and you need to shuttle these ions back and forth and do gates. Now, this vision really will require a lot of engineering, and that engineering is happening right now in most of the leading ion trap groups. I would say Dave Weiland's group at NIST has really taken the lead in this direction. They're building very complicated ion traps. This is the one that is a workhorse for them for many years. It's only a linear array where they have several different zones. This one's more complicated. This is an example from our group, turning ions around a corner and so forth. So this still does require more development. I would say no gates, no entanglement, very simple entanglement operations have been done using this shuttling idea, but it hasn't been scaled yet to beyond a few. Okay, so I want to talk about a rather new, it might seem old, but a rather new idea of indeed shoving lots of ions in one trap, not a million, but maybe 50 or 100. And the question is, why hasn't this been done already? Well, the main reason is if you try to put lots and lots of ions in a linear crystal, you'll end up forming a zigzag. And that's because if you want the lowest energy configuration of a bunch of Coulomb crystals to be aligned, you have to weaken the weak axis quite a bit. And that the anisotropy of the trap, these are harmonic frequencies, the radial frequency divided by the axial frequency, it grows almost linearly with n. So if you want 100 ions in a trap, it's going to be 100 times weaker, well, maybe 80 times weaker along the z-axis. And eventually, well, you run out of depth. You're lowering the lip so much that the ions are going to leak out. The ones on the end are spaced very far from their neighbors, and they become most susceptible to heating and so forth. If you don't satisfy that inequality, then you'll form a zigzag, and that may be obvious. If you squeeze the ends too much, they'll buckle in the middle, and you can get very interesting crystals. But for technical reasons involving something called micromotion, which is a real scary word to ion trappers, we want to avoid that. We need all the ions to be along a line. So this is a rather, well, maybe it's not so obvious, but the new idea suggested by Lu-Ming Duan and his group is to trap ions in a uniform crystal. Now, how you get a uniform crystal, I won't talk about. It's actually not so hard. You need more like a quartic trap than a harmonic trap along the axis. It turns out a quartic will get you a good distance of the way, but there are other potentials that will do that. The point is, if the ions are uniformly spaced, it turns out that the condition for a linear crystal is independent of n. Now, there are subtleties in this equation. I don't have time to go into them, but it assumes that they're separated by some constant distance, S. So if we want to add an ion, we have to, this is sort of a flat bottom trap. It's not harmonic. It's flat bottom, and when we, even a box, if you want to think of it that way. And when you add an ion, you have to move the walls out a little bit. That's the trick. So you sort of need maybe a reconfigurable ion trap of some such. But in any case, I'm betting, and this hasn't really been done yet with small very small ion traps, I'm betting that this will allow us to stabilize much larger crystals that have been used before. And the other idea here is that instead of using the conventional axial modes of motion along the z-axis, which is pretty much where 95% of all work in ions has concentrated, we intend to use the transverse modes of motion. And let me talk about that a little bit more. So in this example, we're going to apply a spin-dependent force. This is really an optical lattice that's moving. With ions, we don't need a stationary lattice because the ions are already confined. We apply a moving lattice to apply our spin-dependent force. In this case, we have two beams. They could be counterpropagating if you want it this way. For practical reasons, we come at 90 degrees like this. We form this sort of walking standing wave, and that wave moves at a certain frequency that we can set with our optical beams. And the force will obviously, in this case, be in the radial dimension. Now, the radial frequencies are very high, and that's always good. It means lower decoherence. For a lot of reasons, they're nice. I would say the most important reason the transverse modes are nice, though, is that they can be scrunched together. They can be very close. Now, if you look at a linear crystal of Coulomb particles, the axial modes are all well separated from another. If you want to resolve one mode of motion, which is pretty much where all of ion traps has concentrated in the last 10 years, you probably want to use the axial modes because they're all well resolved. In particular, the center mass mode, the lowest one, is or the next one after that, these two have been the workhorse of all ion trap quantum gates. The transverse modes, you can squeeze these together as much as you want, depending on the anisotropy. If you make the ions further apart, the modes get closer together. And you might rebel at that and say, well, you're not going to resolve one mode of motion. That's exactly right. We're going to couple to all the modes of motion. And this is what's interesting. So the transverse modes, because they're experiments are typically several megahertz of the transverse modes, whereas these are quite a bit lower, we can control the mode spacing. There's another degree of freedom. And again, the scheme we're interested in, we don't need to or want to resolve the modes. We're going to use all the modes. And that's going to be scalable, because if we have 100 or 101 ions, it doesn't matter. We're coupling to all the modes. So this is really the clincher, I think, for this scheme. This is by far the messiest math in my talk, and because this is a mathematical institute, I guess I don't feel too bad. This is the Hamiltonian of this system. It's basically force times x. It's a spin-dependent force times x. There's the spin dependence. That's the sigma x operator in this case. Let's see. We have a force there's some Rabi frequency. That's our basic force. And we have a wave vector delta k times x. That's the x term. And here we have, I've broken up x in terms of summing over all the ions I and all modes k. And these are the normal mode raising and lowering operators. And we're in the rotating frame at the laser frequency. Now, this parameter mu is important because this is basically, this controls how fast that walking wave is moving. Another trick, you'll note that I'm skipping lots of steps here. These two off-resonant lattice beams have a beat note at the qubit frequency, the hyperfine splitting. So if mu is equal to zero, then they will cause spin flips. That's the sigma x operator. When mu is not zero, they can couple to normal modes. And this is going to be of interest to us when mu is not zero. So, for instance, we might apply mu to be near one of these transverse or many of these transverse modes, and we can get interesting spin-dependent forces. It turns out that there are many regimes here. In fact, pretty much all of the gates can be cast in this form, no matter what you do. You resolve one mode or you couple to all modes. But we're going to be interested in particular in a limit where we can eliminate the phonons. That is, our detuning from any of the phonon modes, any of the sidebands, if you want, is much bigger than the Rabi frequency. And in that case, you're justified in eliminating the motional modes, and there's no entanglement with the phonons. You can just eliminate them, and you end up with a pure spin-spin interaction. Again, this is not new stuff. This is one limit of all the quantum gates that have been used in ions so far. But the interesting thing is, in this coupling, it's an XX coupling in this case. That could also be YY or ZZ, actually, with slight changes in that lattice. What's interesting is this coupling matrix between all spins I and J. These are all constants in front. We have laser geometry, laser power, mass of a single ion there, M. The B's are the normal mode transformations between I and mode K. And you have this resonant denominator. So clearly, if mu is equal to one of the normal modes, this will blow up. You're making phonons. But this is sort of a dispersive interaction. And by controlling that detuning, controlling the laser, you can control the form of this spin-spin interaction. And there's a wealth of different Hamiltonians that you can simulate. And this is what we're very interested in right now. The same type of physics you can use to make quantum gates if you focus down on individual ions, as I guess I hinted in one of these earlier slides. This one here, where you might do the same thing by focusing on just two ions. But I want to talk briefly on some of our recent work on trying to simulate systems of spins. Now, again, these are cute but useless simulations so far. But just wait. Not today, but wait, give us a few years. Okay, so with two spins, things are really trivial because, there's only one coupling, J12. And here, in this experiment, we applied this Hamiltonian after preparing the ground state of the spin system without the Hamiltonian. That is, we prepared down. We can optically pump to down. We apply this Hamiltonian, and we watch the dynamics, and we can basically measure what J is. And we vary the detuning here across the two sidebands. Now, here I've blown up the axis I showed here. Just with two ions, there's only two modes, these top two guys, and they're around 4 megahertz or so. And we've spaced our modes to be only a few hundred kilohertz apart. We measure basically the spin dynamics by looking at up and down and so forth. And by measuring their frequency, we can extract what these J couplings are. And we can extract a sign by surrounding this H effective with other operators that tell you rotations in different around different axes. Single spin rotations allow us to do that. And the theory in red is just this formula here, with previously measured parameters of all these things. And black is the data, and there's no parameters here. So, I mean, we have very good control over the system. We understand what's going on. Well, with two ions, maybe not so interesting. Well, here's the same thing with three ions, and I would say three ions is not just 1.5 times more interesting than two ions. In this context, three ions is really interesting. There are two possible interactions, a short-range interaction, nearest neighbor, and a next nearest neighbor, which, well, I'll just call it next nearest neighbor. It's not exactly long-range. But there are two interactions. They can compete. You can get very interesting regimes here. So here we have J12 is the nearest neighbor, and J13 is the next nearest neighbor. Data's a little more noisy, you'll notice. Oh, I forgot to mention, there are three normal modes now. The center mass mode is the highest one. We've scaled this x-axis. The tilt mode is the next lowest one, and then the lowest one is the so-called zigzag mode. And you can see when we get too close to one of these modes, the coupling goes up. We didn't venture that close to make phonons, actually. But there are very interesting regimes here. For instance, maybe you don't see this here, but when you get really far away from resonance, this one's 8 times bigger than that. Same over here, although I didn't show the data all the way out far. Why 8? Well, in that regime, it's a dipolar coupling. And these three equally spaced ions, the 1 and 3 are 1/8 the interaction as 1 and 2 or 2 and 3. But also, I'll highlight this point right here, where the next nearest neighbor anti-ferromagnetic interaction is equal to the nearest neighbor ferromagnetic interaction. This is called frustration. If 1 and 3 want to be anti-aligned, that is, they have a positive J, what does the middle one do? Well, it has to, in fact, you form an entangled state if you're in the ground state of this system. So this is a pretty interesting system to think about as our springboard to go to much bigger spin systems. Okay, so the next plots, more colorful and probably much more confusing. All I've done here, ignore this axis now, the J axis. I'm changing the Y axis here to denote the size of an external magnetic field. So I've added a magnetic field here. So this is a classic icing model with a transverse magnetic field. And as you vary the ratio of B over J, you see different ground states. And the color code in these regions tells us how ferromagnetic we are along the x-axis. So for instance, when B is huge, we expect that the ions to be along y. They're disordered along x. But when B is very small, down here, they're ordered along x depending on whether it's ferromagnetic or anti-ferromagnetic. So this is a pretty interesting phase diagram. And this is an interesting point I mentioned before. There's a fairly sharp feature here between ferromagnetic order along x and anti-ferromagnetic order along x from that frustration I talked about. Now, in these other regimes, it's pretty boring. That's because I'm plotting the wrong variable. In these regimes, we have a winning anti-ferromagnetic interaction, and I'm just plotting the probability of being ferromagnetic. So there are other variables we can plot to make that interesting. I just didn't plot it here. Okay, quickly, in some preliminary experiments, we prepared the ground state of a large magnetic field, and we adiabatically ramped that down to follow the ground state. So this is sort of, I wouldn't call it ground state quantum computing. It's really trying to simulate the ground state of a complicated spin system. Okay, so I won't get in. Well, we are measuring order along x, so we have to surround the whole experiment by rotations. But this is the meat of the experiment. We turn on a J, and we turn on a very high magnetic field, and we ramp that thing down. And this is the calculated ground state for our system. This is the calculated evolution from an actual ramp, which was too fast. We weren't exactly adiabatic. And this is preliminary data. It's okay data, but this is not a quantum gate, so we don't care about phase coherence, which I love about this experiment. This is more physics-driven than quantum computing-driven. This is not data, this is theory. Here's another picture, pretty much the same picture I showed here. A little more finely grained. I've rescaled the x-axis again. Now, this is going to get worse and worse as I finally show you the data. This is the exact ground state in terms of B over J and this other funny parameter that tells you sort of like the range of the interaction in this 1D icing model, in this icing model. Here is the theory over the range that we ramp the magnetic field. So we don't go all the way down to zero for technical reasons. It's a little less nice. Here's the theory given our experimental ramp. So you see some wiggles as you lower the magnetic field. And here's the data. Okay, so worse, worse, worse. And you sort of see some of the signatures that we were looking for, but again, this is preliminary data, and I think we're busy retaking this and working on putting more ions in the trap. So there's the beautiful picture, and there's what we have so far. I guess a few angles here. One is that as we increase the number of ions, all of these transitions become really sharp. This is not a very sharp transition, going from disorder to ferromagnetism. You see it's very soft. That's because N is only three spins. This is a blow up of this region right here, I guess, going from blue to red with 9 ions instead of 3. I mean, this is really sharp here, this transition. And so all these effects will get much more interesting as we increase the number of ions. Of course, the other interesting thing is as we go across these phase boundaries, the pattern of entanglement should change. A frustrated system, the ground state is entangled, and we can measure that directly here. Okay. One thing I really want to point out to maybe connect with what Terry talked about a little bit, we are certainly interested in very interesting, these really complex spin lattices that can do things, topological and so forth. Now, you might think that's a 1D crystal. It is definitely not a 1D crystal because the interactions are long range. Every ion interacts with its neighbor. Again, by shaping the laser appropriately, we should be able to take advantage of that. By making it much harder by having XX, YY, and ZZ interactions, we could think about doing some kind of a simulation of a Kataev lattice and find its ground states, whose entanglement is very interesting. It's an error-correcting code, in fact. So this is one direction we're very interested in. Okay. Okay, now I have a few minutes to change topics on you. Another way to scale these ion traps doesn't involve phonons, not necessarily. It involves photons. And this is sort of complementary in that phonons are confined. These ions are spaced by microns, so if you have phonons coupled between these ions or the Coulomb interactions, very short range with respect to big distances or geographic distances. And there's, of course, great interest in linking ions with light for quantum communication purposes, but also I'll return to these ideas of making a much larger entangled state, even if your photons aren't going super far. But let me repeat some things that maybe we heard already this morning, especially in the context of our previous speaker. Terry talked about these quantum dots. Ions, of course, have selection rules that are very good. They're not approximations. These are atomic clocks, after all, and the selection rules are given to us by nature. Now, forget for a moment that these atoms are charged. They're just atoms sitting there. Now, we prepare a quantum bit up and down. We've been doing this for a few years now. When we send a fast laser pulse whose bandwidth is bigger than the ground state here, we, in fact, should be preparing a superposition in the excited P state. Now, this P state only lives for a few nanoseconds, but the pulses we use are a few picoseconds. So when the pulse is done, we could have left some population back here, but we certainly can only make one excitation here. And in fact, the qubit should be preserved in that excited state. In a few nanoseconds, it's going to radiate, and things get complicated. Even for a spin 1/2 nucleus, we get these four possible decay channels. Now, I should have put probabilistic up in the title. This is a probabilistic linkage, so we're free to throw away whatever we want. So we're going to throw away the sigma decays, and therefore the atom returns right where it started. But it's changed in the sense that it emitted a photon, and that photon carried away information on the state of that quantum bit. So if we had a superposition of up and down, we now have a superposition of up and down that's entangled with the color of the emitted photon. So this is an example of a frequency qubit. You can do the same thing with polarization qubits and so forth, as we heard earlier today, this morning, and this afternoon. For the experiments I'll talk about, the frequency qubit turns out to be most convenient because it returns us right back to our nice clock state qubit. Okay, I call this a post-selected entangled state because the photon probably didn't make it through the polarizer, probably didn't even make it to the polarizer, because this is an atom right now coupled from free space into a lens. It's a very rare event that we actually get this photon out. Okay. But when we put two of these ions together, of course, things become very interesting. Here I changed isotopes on you. 174 doesn't have nuclear spin at all. In fact, there's no spin qubit. You can think of it as just one ground state here. And this experiment is just another version of the Hong-Wu-Mandel interference, this time using very good single photon sources, if slow. These single photons come from single atoms. Of course they're single photons. You can't get two photons out of this single atom. You can get background light and so forth. But the contrast of the interference is very good. And so here we're looking at coincidence events on two photodetectors, given that the photons were fairly well mode matched on the beam splitter. In fact, that residual peak is from the lack of mode matching of a couple of percent. So this is just kind of the end of a long list of other experiments that have demonstrated Hong-Wu-Mandel effects. This time in a trapped ion. Again, pretty slow, but very high fidelity. Okay, so now I'm going to change isotopes back to 171, so now we have a qubit. And you'll remember that we had, if we do this twice, so it's two ions, we have this double entanglement in a sense. No entanglement on left and right yet, between 1 and 2, I guess, as I labeled. And now we wait for the Hong-Wu-Mandel effect to take over, and we look for joint events on these two photodetectors, and as most of you in this audience know, this will herald an entanglement of the remaining spin. This is no longer post-selected, it's heralded, and it's useful for further quantum information processing or entanglement distribution and so forth. Furthermore, maybe we'll hear a little more from Christoph talking later in the session, this type of a two-photon interference is much less sensitive to noise than single-photon interferometers. And ion motion. If this ion moves around, that's just like having interferometer phase noise. Okay, so I'll skip through most of this. This data is from a year and a half ago or so. Well, if we made this entangled state, we can do all the usual tests, including tomography and so forth. More recently, we've improved our Bell signal. Actually, that was motivated by this result here. Turns out these two atoms are separated by a meter. And we have nearly perfect detectors, well beyond the detector threshold in Bell's required for closing the Bell loophole, the detector loophole. But they're separated by a meter, and although the measurements are slow, so they're not strictly non-local, there's some interesting things you can do with regard to random number generators that are device independent. And our theorist colleagues, Stefano Pironio, Antonio Asin, and Serge Massar have helped us understand this could be interesting for random number generators. Again, everything here is slow, but after several hours of data, we can prove that a certain number of private bits were generated in this setup. Let's see. The 2-qubit gate is very similar to what I just described, only now we upload a qubit in the two spins, and wait for the joint detection. And you know, I'll skip over this. I don't want to skip over this. This is the slow. I keep telling you that probability of this working is really low. And this turns out to be formally equivalent to a probabilistic gate with admittedly very, very low probability. In fact, I'm going to skip. Our fidelities are around 90% for all these things. You can do teleportation, which is a specific case of this gate, teleportation of matter qubits over long distance. Probabilistic, though. I'll skip over that. The main point, of course, is that it takes 12 minutes on average to teleport a single qubit 1 meter, so it's kind of useless. I guess it falls in the cute but useless category. We certainly need more time if we want to scale this up, and we need more qubits. And the main problem in this 10 to the minus 8 measure is that we're just not collecting that much of the light. We really need to couple these atoms to cavities and so forth. I see Nicola Shizan in the audience. I always quote you, if we can get from 2 millihertz to 1 hertz, we're in good shape. The engineers will take us another 3 orders of magnitude or so. So we actually think we can get from there to there involving a modest coupling to a cavity. And that's because these small numbers, they're all squared. It's a 2-photon process. So if we can just get a factor of 30 or 20 in each atom photon coupling, that's a modest gain. We should be able to get maybe up to a hertz. So I wish I had more. Well, I'm glad I don't, because I don't really understand cluster states too much. But my colleague Wu-Ming Duan does. And this same type of connection, as we heard Terry talk about, allows us to make a cluster state. But these atoms are, of course, memories, very stable memories. And there's a good amount of overhead involved in this generation of a 2D cluster state. This is a nice table to kind of hone in on that. If we want to make a 10 to the 9 qubit cluster state with a small error like that, here we are at 2 to the 10 to the minus 8. This is how many trials we have to make. So it's not exponential, but it's pretty much, I'm experimental. That's exponential. as we increase the probability to 10%, now that's going to be hard to match, hard to reach. I think we'll be able to hit 10 to the minus 3 or something, which still is not a very good exponent. But the scaling here is not not exponential. This is more of an academic result. I think the more interesting thing is, I didn't talk about the Coulomb force at all in the second part of the talk. Well, let's bring that back in. Well, if we do that, now we can hook things up much more efficiently. And this is a very simple example of that, where we probabilistically link nearest neighbors, of course, along a distance. We simultaneously do this to all pairs. And then when they all fire off, it takes log n time for that to happen. Then we do all deterministic gates afterward. Okay, so this is very interesting, and I think it's unique to ions. Ensembles can't do that. Other systems with which you can think of quantum repeaters, they're not able to do this because we can't do deterministic gates very well yet. Okay, so this is, I think, my last slide. The big picture here is that we should really think about linking these two architectures, both photonic networks linking registers of ions. But within a single register, you may shuttle ions around, do whatever, have this flat bottom trap I talked about. This may allow you to get 50 to 100 ions, maybe a few hundred ions, but I really think at that point you're going to have a hard time controlling the phonons of that many ions, whether you shuttle or not. So that's when you have to stop and move on to photons. And this figure, it's kind of inspired by what happens in CMOS, where we have one layer of transistors and 12 layers of interconnects. It's all the interconnects. At some point, you have to give up on the number of transistors you have because there's so many wires. And I think this could play a role in quantum computing as well. And so I think ions may not be the winner in the long run, but we have to think of different architectures, different approaches. And I think ions are going to continue to be a test bed for all these ideas in the years to come. So this is my group. We're, as you probably know, we moved from Michigan to Maryland a couple years ago now, and we're pretty much going full steam now on these projects. Thanks for your time.